Good morning and welcome to Holden. Today is Monday, 19th of July, 1999, and in Fireside Room is Ann Peterson, the creation as composition and improvisation, the composition of creation, number 99-1. Let's listen in.
I think I'm supposed to say roll the tape or something like that. This first session is entitled, the whole theme is called Creation as Composition and Improvisation. And today's theme specifically is on the composition of creation. Just to give you a little background about the handout that you have, first of all, I usually don't prepare this much, but I thought it might be helpful since I already had it in this form. This is actually an up-and-coming manuscript, so it looks a little bit more like something you'd send to a publisher, which is what it was. But I thought it might be helpful because it gives you a paragraph summary of some of the sessions up here and kind of a continuity or flow of what the week looks like, though I think each session here can be considered discrete and unique. I don't think you need to be at all the sessions in order to figure out what I'm up to. So the first several pages kind of outline the sessions. Then there are a couple pages of quotes on worship and liturgy that I'll be using toward the end of the week on the fifth session, which is called Liturgy, something about improvisation by conversion or something like that. And then the last three pages, when I was up here 3 years ago, people kept asking for bibliography, and I'm one of those people who said I would send it in the mail, and of course I never did. So this is a little advanced promise to those of you who like to collect bibliographic material, and I tried to at least cite some of the major sources. There's handouts right there, feel free to come on in. Cite some of the major sources that I've used in preparation for these sessions and for my work. This topic grows out of interest in the first book that I ever tried to write, which is somewhere up at the Holden Bookstore. And one of the chapters is on improvisation. And out of that grew a developing interest and desire to write a second book, which you'll see and hear kind of the workings out of. I am not an expert in jazz or the blues. My undergraduate degree is in music, I was a piano and flute major. I went to Concordia for a couple years and graduated from Montana State University, and I taught music part-time for about 10 years in Catholic schools while my husband, who is a high school band director, kind of put me through graduate school. So we both share a common love and interest in music. In fact, not tomorrow, but later in the week, my husband Gary will be helping me teach these sessions. He'll be doing the one particularly on creativity and improv, helping you learn how and maybe do a little improv in the session, and then he'll be talking a little bit about the structure and form of the blues. My training in improvisation was as the high school stage band piano player, of which I learned how to freeze up and look at the score. I'd see like a B-flat 7 with a raised ninth and a flat 5 chord and think, I have no idea what to do with it. So improvisation for me has come to mean a much broader metaphor than just jazz. It comes in many of the arts. The opening night when I was here on Saturday night, we saw names are skipping me already. The Potter, Don Hunt, do a wonderful opening liturgy, Vespers, on what I thought was a good example for me of what I mean by improvisation. So improv, as you'll come to study it this week, is not just doing your own thing. In fact, improvisation is a highly structured art form. As you know, with the blues, is built on a repetitive harmonic structure. The blues has a repetitive chord progression that goes over and over and over again, but that allows you then the freedom to move into that. So my background, like I said, is in theology. I teach at Augustana College, the one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I've developed, my background really is in Lutheran theology, did some work on my dissertation in Luther, but also in a school of theology called process theology that's based on the thinking of Alfred North Whitehead, and so I'm an avid Whiteheadian to some degree, and I've developed other strong interests in feminist theology, and most recently I spent really the last 6 or 7 years of my professional career deeply embedded in the conversation of religion and science. And that's kind of the undergirding agenda for this whole week, is to look at how we think about who we are as church and what the claims of the Christian faith mean in light of a world that's highly scientific and technological. And finding that those questions really drive much of what our world is about. And finding for myself that the old models that we've talked about in using to describe God in the world often don't work very well in the light of a scientific and technological age. So I found the language of jazz, of improvisation, as a language that actually fits into, connects with, and moves better with our understanding of the scientific world than does some different models that we've used in traditional Christian theism. So that's really kind of my driving question, and I think there are great ethical, Dan can help me out this week with some of this, ethical implications as well for how one lives improvisationally. We'll talk about how the Christian tradition has lived with what I think sometimes are very static categories. God laid out the cosmic blueprint at the beginning, and our goal is to sort of live out God's plan, which has already been set out ahead of us, and I think in that kind of scheme, human freedom becomes an illusion. And we live with very rigid, tight categories, where improv requires us to live in an ensemble, to trust the other members of the, to reciprocate back and forth. It's much more of a dialogical way of being in the world. And God's role, if you think about a jazz ensemble, is very different, and we'll talk about that as the session progresses. So that's really my background, religion and science, feminist theology, literature. And for just 1 second, I'd like you to listen to just one cut on a CD. This is Ida Cox, Wild Women Don't Get the Blues. Comes from a collection called Essential Women. It's from the House of Blues. Some of you may know
Essential Women.
Yep, Essential Women in Blues, the House of Blues. I'm not an expert in the blues. I've just started listening in the last couple years, mainly thanks to living in Chicago. We used to head up to the Kingston Mines, which is a fairly famous blues club up there. And our neighbor at the seminary had a group up there called the Dion Payton and the 47th Street Blues Band. And we used to go up there and listen. And slowly developed what I think is a growing interest in the blues. My husband is much more conversant with the artists, but I'm hoping that by the end of the week, you'll hear God in the metaphor of Ida Cox singing Wild Women Don't Get the Blues. So that's the reason of looking at that, is to open up your vision a bit of who God might be as women singing the blues. I'd like to start this morning with a quote from one of my favorite books. One of my favorite authors that I've read bits and pieces of is on your syllabus. Her name is Mary Catherine Bateson. Some of you may know her. I see a smile in the background. She's written a book that I've read snatches of called Composing a Life. It's about the integration of 5 women's stories, and she uses very strongly the metaphor of improvisation. In fact, it's one of the first places that I ran across that. Another of her books that's also on the syllabus And I don't know why I didn't order these for the bookstore, but you can get both of these at Barnes & Noble, at those kind of places. A book called Peripheral Visions, that again, she uses the theme of improvisation. The quote goes like this: "Just as change stimulates us to look for more abstract constancy, so the individual effort to compose a life framed by birth and death, carefully pieced together from disparate elements, becomes a statement on the unity of living. These works of art, still incomplete, are parables in process, the living metaphors with which we describe the world." What she tries us to think about is to lift up the notion that our life is really a living metaphor, that we're in the process of composing our life, that the composition isn't fixed, that when God works on our life, what happens is that the composition unfolds, and in large part, that's who we are. The composition is unique to us. So one of the living, and I like her language of living metaphor, some of our metaphors, I think, in the tradition have become dead and stagnant, static. They aren't coming to life, particularly for some groups of people. I know sometimes as a woman in liturgy, both Gary and I were near tears the first night again in Holden. It happens every year I come up here. I sort of sit and grind my teeth through Our Savior's Lutheran Church for the whole year, and then I can come up to Holden and find the incredible relief that I sense in worshiping in a community that uses all kinds of rich metaphors for worship life. And that's such a relief to me. I don't feel like I'm on edge the whole time. Mm-hmm. So this is a wonderful way for me of talking about how theology functions, which is as living metaphors. My major work, you can do all kinds of theology. You can do historical theology. Dan Lyrequist is really a historian and does what I would consider historical theology. At least that's part of her life. Biblical theology. I was so excited about the book of Revelation this morning, I might even read it. Someone said to me rather prophetically, "Well, we won't need Bibles in your session, will you?" And I said, "No, most theologians, that's a hazard." So Barbara Rossing inspired me this morning to pick up the book of Revelation and look at that. You know, there are confessional theologians, those who spend the time in the writings and traditions of their background. I've done some of that work myself in the Lutheran tradition. The other kind of theology that I do most of the time is what I call constructive theology. That is kind of making frameworks to put the understanding of God and the world together. So what I'm doing with you for this week is what I call constructive theology. That is kind of laying pieces together to build a framework, even though it may fall down next week. I think the danger about theology is that you think you build a foundation that's going to last for 2,000 years and it never changes. And what we find out is there are certain things that hold the tradition together, much like the 12-bar blues pattern, but that fluctuates and changes depending on the culture, the people who put that music together. So for me, constructive theology is what the church should be about. I'm a lay person. I struggled for years about whether or not to become ordained. I consider myself a lay person in a sense, a professional theologian. That's what I do as a living. But I think theology belongs first and foremost to lay people. One of my favorite theologians in his later years, John Cobb Jr., is spending his last years of his work making sure that people in the laity take seriously their vocation as theologian. I think theology, like medicine, has been left to the experts. And it's time to sort of reclaim that territory. So part of what I'm hoping to do this week is to allow you to think about yourself as a theologian. So constructing theology. Okay, to develop the metaphor of composition or composing a life is to begin with the musical language of creation. And this may seem, I feel like I might be preaching to the choir up here or teaching to the choir up here, but I'm not sure. So a lot of what I think about comes out of my conversations with undergraduates. I spend most of my life in the classroom at a college with students who come to learn about religion at a confessional school. So the questions that they bring frame much of what I think about. And what I find that a lot of my students come to college with is what I call the me and Jesus syndrome. A highly individualized belief about salvation that has to do with what Barbara spent time talking about this morning, that's sort of enculturated in American Pietism. That what salvation means is accepting Jesus as Lord and Savior. Fellowship of Christian Athletes is the largest group on our campus, and they do a lot of good, but they also spend most of their time praying for our department, so we know we get in a little trouble. But Fellowship of Christian Athletes talks about this language of Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior, and that what's important about that is getting to heaven. And a lot of talk that begins to talk about us and them kind of categories. I'm a Christian, you're not. And sort of deciding who's in and who's out. I thought Martin Wells opened that text up last night about the weeds and the that was one of the best sermons I've heard on that text. Because I think too often we spend time deciding who the weeds are and not looking inside our own selves. So that was really helpful for me tonight, last night. But I think Christian theology has often started with Jesus as the sole central focus of what it means to be Christian. In theological language, you can talk about that as Christocentrism. That is, everything is centered around the person of Jesus in such a way that the focus of salvation or the message of Christianity focuses solely on the human individual's efforts in that sense to get to heaven. And that's the popular piety that I would say the vast majority of my students bring into the classroom. It's what I hear being preached on TV. It's very often what I hear being preached on Sunday mornings. Joseph Sittler, one of my favorite theologians, in many of his books, talks about why it is that we never hear a sermon preached on creation, on the world around us. Now, at Holden Village, that's a given, right? We partly just being in this environment, it's easy to think that the whole Christian world thinks about this wonderful environmental world that we live in as the center of God's message. But for a lot of Christians, the Christian message has focused on a highly individualized, commercialized sense of the self. And I think that's rooted in, and we'll talk about that much later in the week, I think that's rooted as much in our, what I would call Enlightenment or American thinking, as it is at all rooted in the gospel. So my attempt is to talk about a framework. Yeah, I can use this one. In which creation is the framework that we understand Jesus. So creation, if you want to say, is the frame around which we put Jesus into. And there's a strong Christian tradition for doing that. For one thing, if you just think liturgically, we begin the Apostles' Creed with, I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator or maker of heaven and earth. We don't start with the second article of the creed. We start with the first article, which is the belief in God as creator. Then the second article, and then the third article. Scripture begins with creation. So those are just, if nothing else, reasons broadly based within the tradition that one puts creation around the framework for understanding who Jesus is. And of course, once you develop into New Testament theology, you can talk about that as Trinitarian. Okay, and we'll get more to that. Another reason to start and begin in creation is that there's more to Jesus or more to salvation than human life. What we want to say about the gospel is that all of God's creation is brought to new creation or redemption. So what you do by being by beginning in creation is to talk about the fact that all the created order is finally redeemed. Last night's text, the Romans passage, Romans 8, is one of, I think, the best for talking about all creations waiting to be redeemed. Colossians, you know, if there are others, you know, you can think of about the language that Paul and other New Testament thinkers use to talk about all of creation being redeemed. I have a silly anecdote that if I don't meet my Airedale in heaven, I don't much want to be there. And I'm sort of joking about that, but I think we need to talk about broadening the scope of God's grace. So that instead of what I call, in very technical, silly theological language, soteriological reductionism, that is bringing down the focus of God's grace to me, instead we expand it, widen it, to include all of creation. And the fundamental, of course, very Lutheran theme for me, very Christian theme of that, is the fundamental notion of God's grace. And that's what I mean by the cantus firmus, the song or the repetitive undergirding melody that goes through all of the Christian tradition, is that it's God's grace which holds together the whole created order. And there are a couple examples of that in the tradition. One that I particularly like is from the theologian Irenaeus. Irenaeus develops the language in what I've put into, I don't think he uses it because it's a much later development, but I've put it into musical language. How many of you in here are musicians at all? Listen or play? I remember in college having piano class, and we studied the sonata allegro form. If you've played like a Mozart sonata or love listening to those, it's a quite highly structured form that was developed particularly in the classical era, and it has three distinct parts to it. The exposition, in which the themes are sort of laid out, you know, the AB form, and you can get very technical, but for our sake we'll listen to it in three ways. The exposition, in which you lay out the themes, the development, which is in the middle section, and there the themes are modulated, that is, changed or transposed into all different kinds of keys, and you pick up the themes from the beginning. But they're changed, often put into minor keys. And then what's called the recapitulation, it's brought back to the beginning, brought back to the head. The themes are redeveloped again in a new way. And that's a nice sort of summary for me of the theology of Irenaeus. That what begins in God's actions in creation, the themes are sort of laid out. And that's what the exposition is about. And then they are developed and modulated, sometimes painfully so, dissonance. I mean, even in good old Mozart, you can hear some very dissonant kinds of chord structures. And then they're brought back again. Barbara, you can help me with anencephalesis. Is that sort of the recapitulation? Okay, the Greek word for bringing it back again. This lovely word for new creation, that is developed again. So Irenaeus is a theologian who really forms what we call more of the Eastern tradition over against somebody like Augustine, but talks about this wonderful development of God's grace in which the purpose of Jesus is laid into the framework of creation. So again, you have this very expansive understanding of God's grace and purpose in the world. And Irenaeus' theology has become quite popular. Because, and we'll talk much more about this later, it fits with an evolutionary worldview. One in which creation isn't sort of set from the beginning, but one in which it expands and develops. So contemporary thinkers like Philip Hefner, who work a lot in the religion and science dialogue, have used Irenaeus' theology. Joseph Sittler, feminist theologians are very sympathetic to the work of Irenaeus. So he's an early church thinker that I think helps us, and I found that musical form helpful for me to understand what he's doing. Another tradition that I'm just beginning to become more familiar with by reading more of and traveling in the lands of is Celtic theology. There's kind of a renaissance of anything Celtic. And it goes anything from Druids to Irish theology to anything that you can find. My first experience of looking at Celtic theology was about 5 years ago. I'd never been abroad, and I had my first opportunity to go to England with a group from Augustana. And part of that trip, any of you been to Lindisfarne? Off the coast of England, it's called Holy Island. If you go up the English coast, it's kind of on the northeast side. It's where supposedly some of the early origins of Christianity moved into England. And one of the famous saints, it's a really dramatic scene. Holy Island or Lindisfarne is cut off by the tide during part of the day. So you can drive out during part of the day and spend 4 or 5 hours. And if you're smart, you get back on your vehicle of transport so you can get out and not spend the night there. We almost got caught the last time we were there. But Lindisfarne is this rugged, desolate island that juts out into the North Sea. One of the most famous Celtic saints that lived on that island for years was named St. Cuthbert. And one of St. Cuthbert's habits was to go out, supposedly, and to stand in the North Sea for hours on end, sometimes through the night. And if you can imagine this really cold, barren landscape. And in the morning he would come in, and the legend is that the sea otters would come in and cover his feet. And St. Cuthbert's remains were at Lindisfarne for a number of years, and supposedly when people were invading Lindisfarne, they pulled up his remains and he was bodily restored, and they were moved to Durham Cathedral, where now the remains of St. Cuthbert are. And if you've seen the movie Elizabeth, any of you, many of the shots of Elizabeth are from Durham Cathedral. So that was a really dramatic place for me. And what I discovered in Celtic theology, one of the books I've mentioned on the list is by a man named Philip Sheldrake. And two themes are very prominent in Celtic theology. One is the image of journey, that is, of being on the way. And to counterpose that is the theme of place. And the geography or the place in which Celtic theology develops is highly significant. So the natural world is the framework out of which much of Celtic theology develops. And again, this is not some romanticization of nature, like, oh, isn't it wonderful to be out in the woods and all sort of sing its praises. It was a strong understanding very often of the harshness of what creation brings. And I think Holden has its own reminders of that. It's easy to sort of romanticize nature, but it also has its very harsh and jagged edges. And Celtic theology is rooted in that tradition. And I had thought about doing this morning, but we won't, because I didn't think about bringing green hymnals in. But some of you may know the hymn, "I Bind Myself Unto This Day in the Strong Name of the Trinity." It's number 170 something or other in the Lutheran Book of Worship. Yeah. And it was one of my favorite songs. It's in the baptism section. It's number 188. "I bind unto myself today the strong name of the Trinity by invocation of the same as three and one and one and three." It starts out with this wonderful Trinitarian beginning, and it's attributed to St. Patrick. So St. Patrick supposedly wrote this when he was being pursued by the Druids. At least that's the legend that I've read. And the legend goes that as St. Patrick was being pursued by the Druid king, he shapeshifted into a deer and composed this song along the way. It's kind of a wonderful image. But one of my favorite verses goes like this: "I bind unto myself today the virtues of the starlit heaven, the glorious sun's life-giving ray, the whiteness of the moon at even, the flashing of the lightning free, the whirlwind's tempestuous shocks, the stable earth and the deep salt sea around the old eternal rocks." Lovely creation imagery that's rooted strongly in a Trinitarian theology. And I think that can be the power of this doctrine of creation, is that much in our roots in the tradition, there are places to talk about how creation is the root for where we begin theology. And it surely was for Luther. As radically Christocentric, or where he found Jesus in everything, Luther, I think, was very much a first article thinker, one who rooted his theology in the doctrine of creation. And he does that very often. We could go on a whole session on this, based on the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." A thinker who picks up on Luther's theology, if you're interested in pursuing that, is a man named Gustav Wingren. An in-house discussion of that, of course, against Karl Barth, who is known as sort of the Christocentric thinker of this generation. But Wingren is one who talks about looking at theology encompassing all of creation. So that's what I mean by sort of the campus firmus of God's grace, rooting who we are in understanding ourselves as rooted in God's creation. Again, to say that salvation is not merely individualistic, but encompasses all of creation. And again, I think that has profound ethical implications. you know, we could begin a conversation about what that means for environmental issues, ecofeminism, a lot of contemporary traditions that I think need to be sort of reintroduced within the doctrine of creation. Okay, let me stop there for a minute. I've been talking 100 miles an hour, and see if you have any comments or questions. Yes?
One of the things that has occurred to me is that it seems like both with Scripture and with Jesus, sometimes what people try to do is squeeze all of their experience into a narrow understanding of those things, mm-hmm. so that if they can't somehow make that connection, then they have to discard experience, or they have to. And it seems to me that with both Scripture and Christ, we can turn it around and say that they serve instead as kind of a flashlight or a light that shines out on all the rest of creation and experience, and kind of helps us get our bearings and shows us what's important to pay attention to and who God is.
That's a nice imagery, because instead of something that constricts or narrows, and it's that notion of enlightening, it's kind of the John imagery of...
You could use it either way, but for me it's much more helpful. Think of it as a expansion, points us out.
I think the fear sometimes, and you can understand, I mean, I have that same trouble sometimes. I think when fear sets in, or you're plagued by ambiguity, or something is disrupting the way you see the world, the tendency, at least for me sometimes, is to hold on to something that's extraordinarily familiar that allows me to gain footing again. The question is whether you're gaining footing that allows you to look out, or whether it's pulling you in even tighter. So I think that's kind of the constant struggle for Christians, because this kind of raises questions about truth and, you know, how do you know sort of what's out there, and how do you know what to trust, and we could have a whole discussion about those kinds of issues. But I think metaphorically, the nice thing about this notion of a living metaphor, a theologian that I like a lot, Elizabeth Johnson, talks about the tradition as the living tradition. Instead of seeing the tradition as something that was laid out in, you know, Jesus, and then we kind of, as one of my favorite clergy says, it kind of drops out of Augsburg Fortress, you know, and you sort of have it there, and there it is, and it sort of stayed that way for thousands of years. My hope is that this theme of improvisation ties, I think, is really, really Lutheran. It ties to the notion of the little Lutheran phrase, semper ecclesia reformanda. The church is always reforming. I never really wanted to go to Germany all that badly. Sometimes the more people talk about going to the Holy Land, the less I sort of want to be there. You know, I don't know. It was just my sort of reservations about, did I really want to go see all that Luther stuff? So this last fall, I got an invitation from Lutheran World Federation to come to a conference in Wittenberg during October, in which about 100 theologians, teachers, graduate students from all over the world were invited to come and think about the subject of Luther's notion of justification in light of, at least in the backdrop of, this new declaration that's happening between the Roman Catholic and Lutheran churches. So I spent 6 days with a variety of Lutherans from all over the world discussing what justification meant in light of particularly what they called economic and technological issues. It was pointed out, of course, that in light of Luther's time, when the printing press came out, some of the technological issues that Luther faced, oddly enough, are happening to us with the web and the internet and access to information. One of the statistics that was quoted was that 80% of the world's internet traffic goes through the U.S. So think about what that means for access to information in other parts of the world. So there was a lot of discussion back and forth between different parts of the world about what justification might mean. And the highlight of this visit was we went to the Schlosskirche, the castle church, on Reformation Day, October 31st. And I expected, of course, the whole service was in German, and I hadn't used my German except to read it in graduate school, so I had a little trouble picking up some of it. But We sang A Mighty Fortress, Ein Feste Burg in German, but with Africans, with Asians, with North Americans, with Europeans, and the castle church was packed. And that in and of itself was kind of interesting. But the really interesting thing is when we entered the church, there was a big poster. I'm going to borrow my mother's coat for a minute. And if you want to see it, you can see it afterwards. We all got these little buttons, and it says, Katharina von Bora, die Lutheran. Okay? And there was this wonderful poster in the front of the church. Cranach, Lucas Cranach, who was one of the famous artists of Luther's time, has this wonderful triptych at the beginning of the church that has a picture of Katharina or Katie holding one of Luther's children. It looks a little bit like the Madonna and Child. So they had taken that segment of Cranach's painting and blown it way up. And it was sitting, huge portrait of Katie and the baby Jesus, or Katie and one of her children, what's there. And this whole year has been dedicated in the province of Saxony-Anhalt to Katie, to Katharina von Bora. And if you know that, the reformer, right there with Luther, not just the wife who sort of kept house, but this very strong, and what followed then were texts and sermons and conversations about the role that Katie played in the Reformation. Very strong-willed woman, obviously, to have to put up with Luther. The financial holder of the Reformation, very educated woman, who did much, really, to help preserve and carry on the structure of the Reform. But held up these virtues of her strength, her intelligence, her capability, and there's that image against what often is held up as sort of the meek, virgin-like, you know, passive pictures that we often get of the Virgin Mary. And that was meant as a reconstruction of what we mean by being a reformer. And that, for me, was a real good example of what I understand improvisation to be. That is to take the structure and the tradition, but to turn it and change it in the context in which we live, so that the community of faith in Germany had begun to realize the importance and the necessity of lifting up Katharina von Bora, and had done this wonderful reconstructive history of her life that will be celebrated this entire year. You can get on their webpage and see all the places that Katie went and did, and it's a wonderful, I think, example of what Lutherans mean by the church is always reforming. So that's a beginning of what I'm starting to mean by improvisation. That improvisation is this structure. I mean, we have certain things about who we are, but it means that they're constantly in the process of developing in new ways. Yeah.
And I have to leave in a few minutes to do dish tea, so that okay. I'm going to get my little word in here.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk further about improvisation kind of from the ecological side, too? Because it seems like it fits beautifully in terms of there are some basic ground rules, laws of nature, ecological things, but within that, there's lots of room for improvisation.
Exactly.
But if you go too far and you play a bad chord and it messes it up.
Right.
But it's when you were talking about maintaining both the creative nature of the world ongoing, but also room for freedom within that. It seems like a wonderful metaphor.
Well, and that's, you know, these sessions are never long enough. That's where the jazz builds on the religion and science metaphor environmentally, that what we're learning about in the language of the group I run with, the Epic of Creation. One book I could recommend that's just, I think, the best commentary on that is by a woman named Ursula Goodenough called The Sacred Depths of Nature. And what she develops is, of course, the Epic of Creation based on evolutionary history. Why was Darwin so radical? Well, it's because this whole notion that creation had a certain fixedness about it, that all the species were laid out in God's plan from the beginning, that creation really had a set form. That worldview stayed all the way up, really, until Darwin, even in the scientific world. So when Darwin comes along and introduces the theme of natural selection, what that means is that chance is built in to the way the world works. And we know that from evolutionary theory, that how the world works is a combination of what you were just saying, Dan, of the structures or laws of nature that seem to hold over. We seem to know that gravity and, you know, there are certain things that remain constant, but there's also this combination of what we would call chance or randomness.
Yeah.
And that forms what I would call a partnership in how the world has developed. So it means a very evolutionary worldview and the notion that novelty or newness is always happening. But if you take that understanding of chance or randomness or risk seriously, I don't think many of our traditional models of God work very well. It blows any sort of notion of divine omnipotence as God controlling the world. You simply can't hold on to that anymore. The notion that God controls and plans everything out ahead of time in a way down to the minute detail just doesn't work, unless you think that chance or randomness is just our inability to sort of perceive the greater plan. And I think that's a dangerous way to go, because then it undermines anything that the scientific world does.
Well, it's so interesting. I work in a high school, and every time science teachers try and introduce evolution as a thought, there are always kids who feel like they are in dangerous mm-hmm. territory, and they'll start writing in their journals, well, let's see, God created the world and there's Earth, and I believe that there's Earth, so I guess I can listen to what my teacher says. I mean, it's really mm-hmm. a struggle for them. It's helpful to mm-hmm. think of this, because I also think about how undervalued the arts are mm-hmm. in a high school or culturally. Mm-hmm. If we believe in a God who creates a fixed universe, and if we believe in creation as being set, then it's hard to value creation done by humans in any kind of artistic sphere also. So it's an interesting way of thinking about mindset.
Now, I think it really does mean some reformulating, and it's not just a conceptual issue. I think it's a way of living in the world. And this notion of ongoing creation, I'm going to go ahead and kind of pick up some of your language and move into this language of the two models that I want to make some contrast about, the maestro and his orchestra, or the jazz ensemble. My first experience, and most of my experience of being in music, has been as a flutist in a concert band. I played a little bit in the Bozeman Symphony Orchestra and the Concordia College Band. But, and I'm using this broadly, please don't take my comments here to mean that I don't like symphony music or I think it's wrong or anything like that. This is just metaphorically speaking. But in general, my experience, particularly the symphony, is that you get your part, right, you get your first flute part to Mozart's symphony, whenever, and you go home and you practice it, and you come to rehearsal, and usually what happens, or you come particularly to the performance, and who's the one we all applaud? The conductor, right? Usually, never in the history of my experience, I've seen one woman conduct in the history of my musical experience. I know there are women symphony conductors, but not many. Usually, he steps up onto the platform, raises his arms, and everybody does their part. Now, there's some room for freedom of expression there, but mostly it's a notion that you get the score, right? It's already laid out ahead of time, and your role is to play that part and to play it well without a mistake. And the audience listens. It's very appreciative, but it's not very dialogical. You listen. I mean, you do participate, but it's still sort of a notion of the conductor directing, moving with the large ensemble. An anecdote that I just love is this year at Allstate Band, my husband took some of the kids that were in his, that made it to Allstate Band, and the conductor was sort of the epitome of the maestro. One of these sort of iron-fisted band directors that screamed at the kids all day if they didn't do what they wanted, and he'd yell at them. And of course, you get away with that because you're a musician. I'm convinced that musicians get away with that more than they should. But anyway, he had written one of the pieces for the performance, and Gary's first chair clarinet player was first here in Allstate Band. This kind of, at first appearance, sort of ditzy, squeaky voice, braces, girl that sat there, and she kept doing, would play the, it was a little kind of solo, and he kept stopping her because he wanted her to hold a fermata longer than she was doing. So he kept yelling at her in rehearsal. Finally, she complied a few times and played it the way he wanted to. Well, the final performance of the Allstate Band concert comes, and they're on, and Gary said all of a sudden he's waving his arms trying, I mean, Gary said it was just really one of those moments that you panic as a band director. Mm-hmm. Here's the conductor waving his arms, and here's Jamie, the clarinet player. She could have cared less what the maestro thought. She went and played the solo the way she wanted to anyway. He's having a raging fit up in front of the band, and they just went on without him. Okay? Now, in the traditional notion of creation, that would be sin, right? Because you've broken the rules of the maestro. I thought it was a wonderful little anecdote about sort of what happens when you take this model to its extreme. That is the notion that in Genesis 1, in the beginning, God lays out everything, and it's planned, right? All I have to do is play my part. I can go home and practice a little bit. I don't even need to think about it because, you know, people who use scripture that way sort of open the book and jab their finger into it, and that's their horoscope for the, I mean, that sort of very notion that everything's laid out ahead of time. It's comforting, right? You can understand why people want that. Gives you a sense of security. But a different model that I want to end with is the notion of the work of the jazz ensemble. My first experience of playing in jazz was in the high school jazz band, which was, I mentioned earlier, one of the more terrifying moments of my life. For one thing, it was contrary to my experience of playing in the concert band. All of a sudden, I had to not only listen to the people in my flute section to be in tune, but I had to listen so carefully to each voice in that jazz ensemble. What the string bass player was doing, what the sax player was doing, and it was a much more what I would call dialogical give and take kind of playing. And the jazz ensemble, Gordon Wickham, who was our high school band director, he'd maybe, you know, when you see the jazz band director do that, you get out and you start the group, and what does the jazz band director do? Usually step aside.
Yeah.
Sometimes Gordon would get his clarinet and play along.
Yes.
Sometimes, like with Doc Severinsen, maybe he composed the chart, and maybe he'd solo with it. But very often, the conductor or the director gets behind in support of those who can come out and solo. And if you've tried soloing in a jazz ensemble, it's not that you get out there to show off. Contrary to what we think of jazz solos as, it's really an ensemble kind of production. Those solos don't happen without the very intimate support of the ensemble. So that jazz music, I think, and one of my favorite quotes about jazz is that it's really a model of servant leadership. It's letting go of being in control, particularly of the conductor's role. It's letting go of the control and moving into to the ensemble. So that the conductor's role is much more that of empowerment than the power over the maestro, being the one who's going to play the score. You get this lovely notion of the one who empowers. And for me, that's the ultimate notion of what it means to be Christian. It comes out of, you know, biblically, Philippians 2, the notion of kenosis, or the emptying of a certain kind of power in order to become part of the ensemble. So to be Christ-minded in Philippians 2 for me is to be part of the ensemble, to let go into the mix. Yes?
Does jazz come out of black tradition?
Yes.
Because blacks are very uninvolved in the symphonies, I believe, that we sing around the country. And I've heard him say that that's not their music.
Right. I have somewhere, and I, a little quote, and I can read this for you. It's by an African-American, Max Roach, who writes the following. When a piece is performed, everybody in the group has the opportunity to speak on it or comment on it through their performance. It's talking about jazz. It's a democratic process, as opposed to Western classical music, in which the two most important people are the composer and the conductor. They're like the king and queen. In a sense, the conductor is also the military official who's there to see that the wishes of the masters or the composers are adhered to, and as a musician, your job may depend on how you conform to the conductor's interpretation. However, a jazz performance, everyone has an opportunity to create a thing of beauty collectively. And the roots of jazz are very much rooted in African traditions of what they call the call and response form of music. We'll look a little bit at this later in the week with the history of the blues. I didn't know anything about the history of the blues, and I've tried to read as much as I can. But jazz is very much rooted in the African-American experience that develops in this country that's rooted in a very different kind of style of music than what has come out of Western European music. And there's a lot being written critically about Western music out of the experience of jazz musicians, in which you get, and interestingly enough, the same kind of language that's criticizing Western European music for being hierarchical and ordered and all that kind of stuff sounds a lot to me like feminist theology that's critiquing much of what we would call a classical Christian tradition. I'll mention this later in the week, but a new book out by Angela Davis on feminism and the blues. Wonderful literature coming out of black women that talk about the role of the blues and particularly the secular nature of the blues as a critique over against Christianity. But I think jazz comes, and that's part of the reason I thought Barbara did a wonderful job this morning talking about Revelations, listening to it from a marginalized perspective. There's concern among the African-American community that too many whites are taking over jazz and the blues. And one can do that in sort of an appropriative way, that you just sort of appropriate their culture. There's another metaphor that I learned, I think, out of a book in here. I mentioned Robert McAfee Brown's book, Theology in the New Key, in which he talks about listening. That's a little bit different posture than sort of taking over. I don't in any way pretend to be an expert or sort of take over the image of blues and jazz, but I've learned a lot by listening to what the blues and jazz have to say and by even participating in it as a form of music. And again, this fits wonderfully in an environmental or scientific worldview in which randomness and chance are built into the very structure of the way the world works. So it means that God's role is not the almighty controlling conductor, but God's much more like the one who moves in and out of the ensemble, who supports those of us to do our soloing. And the last sort of term, this word is attributed to Philip Hefner, the word co-creator. For some people, that's an offense. Some of my students take great offense at that language. It's prefaced really by the language he uses of the created co-creator. That's our vocation in life. We're created by God, so it's not as if we make ourselves. But our vocation in life is to co-create with God, so that we become participants in the composition of creation. It's not as if God laid it out all ahead of time. I mean, human history, what's that scale? If you look, human history is like 1 second before midnight on a calendar year or something in evolutionary history. And who knows where it goes from here? I mean, we're surely not the end. I mean, I think we've been taught to think, of course, that humans are the apex of all creation, and we're the end product, we're God's great end. Well, Darwin sort of shot that down. What we know is that we're part of God's plan, but we're surely not the only part and clearly not the end. But we have great ethical responsibilities. I like the image of created co-creator because it means we have a responsibility for how we live in the world. We can't just sit back and say, well, all I have to do is play my part in the symphony. You know, there's a responsibility for how we listen and how we create the composition of the world. So I think it has incredible ethical implications.
So is that how you see the church?
Yeah, I'd like to see the church in much more of a community kind of way. It's hard to translate, and that doesn't, you know, I think there's some work to be done on this, but I get a sense of that up at Holden, and I get a sense of it at various places throughout, that the community, when it functions well, serves more to lift people up, to empower them, so that the function, I think it's a much more, you know, Kathy could speak to this, but I would hope it would be more of a breathing space for clergy instead of feeling like the maestro. Right, that's that sort of old model. But what the clergy should be there for is to be interpreters and helpers with the tradition, but not in such a way as that they're the ones who lay out the score and we just have to play the part. But the church functions in this kind of way. I think it's really hard, though. I think it's counterintuitive to the way most of us function on Sunday morning.
But you think part of what helps Holden provide that is just that the balance is different between the things that are givens and the things that are random and chance. I mean, the community is constantly changing here. We have to improvise. Whereas in a community congregation, it's just, you're always kind of fighting those other forces.
And I think, just historically, it's always helpful to remember where we've come from. And whether we listen to the Epic of Evolution or whether I read Martin Luther, I always have to remember that the community I'm part of, in a large way, is more like Holden. And that's hard to feel sometimes when you're with the same people over and over. And for many families, I know my sense of being has not been that. I did sort of a transplant, and family's been all over the country. But in our part of the country, families have been rooted very many times for centuries. So I think it may be easier up here because of the transitions.
Well, and because of the financial support. If we're giving money to Holden, it's like throwing money down a wishing well. I'm just wishing that some good things will happen up here sitting over in Scrim, Washington. I'm just hoping that presenters like you will come in and encourage other people to think more largely. I think Holden draws the jazz players.
I wonder if the rest of the week you might introduce the idea of the Holy Spirit working through the individual. And the language you use seems to be setting that up.
Yeah.
Because if we listen, what do we listen to? And we know a lot about prayer, we know a lot about centering and emptying ourselves. And what happens at that point is quite improvisation.
Yeah, it's open to the Spirit. I'm great at finding quotes, but this is the last one I'll leave with you. Elizabeth Johnson uses the language of the Spirit, and she says, God is like a master theatrical improviser in life performance, amplifying and embroidering each theme as it presents itself, like a choreographer composing steps in tandem with the creative sights of the whole dance troupe, like a composer of a fugue, starting with a simple melody and weaving a complex structure of endlessly folding it back upon itself. Like a jazz player inspired by the spirit of the audience and the night to improvise riffs upon a basic melody. Like a designer who sets the rules of a game that includes wild cards and then lets it play. And she connects that all to the language of God as Spirit. So it's, I think it's a really interesting imagery, but for me, it's a constant reminder that one lives life then in a sense of a certain letting go, of a certain, and it implies a certain trust, and that's why I think the congregational life becomes more difficult. It's easy to practice it up here, but I know even trying strategies in the classroom, you know, or anywhere in our life, and what I'm hoping my husband will do later in this week as we learn sort of what jazz is, and to look at the incredible structure, we'll also learn that I think part of what the tradition provides us, though, is the freedom. I'm not one who says we just jettison it. I'm not talking about improv as jettisoning the tradition at all. In fact, one of my favorite experiences was on sabbatical, where I spent 5 months at a Benedictine community up at St. John's in Collegeville, Minnesota. And those people know the tradition. I mean, if you've read Kathleen Norris, I can't say her stuff's over in the bookstore. One of her books, The Cloister Walk, is written in the community that I did sabbatical in. These Benedictines know how to worship. Last night, one of the pieces that was sung by the choir was by Dolores Dufner. We watched her work every week with the Benedictine community. The first time I worshiped with those sisters at St. Ben's, I've never felt worship like that in my life, ever. Because they know the tradition, but they're free to move in and out of it in such a wonderful way that it's like listening to a tightly knit jazz ensemble. I mean, they know what they're doing, but it's based on this intense community life. And after interviewing and talking with a lot of the monks and sisters about what it's like to live in community with people you can't stand. And this, I think the church needs to spend time listening to these communities. The Benedictines know what community means. And it's not some sugary, oh, we just love everybody. I mean, you know, Brother Wilford talks about the guy who can't stand living next to, but, you know, one week he has to serve him dinner, and the next week he does his laundry. And I mean, there's a certain sense of place. The Benedictines are also, they're not all orders are like this, but Benedictines are rooted to place. So they make a commitment to the community, to the people, to the life. I was so excited about that place, we named our dog after him. So we have St. Benedict's Wilfred, and I have my Benedictine Airedale that we talk about in sort of pleasure of this wonderful community that I think provides a model. So if I can think of a model for how to live an ensemble or jazz, I would say go find a group of Benedictines and spend some time with them. Yes?
I was just going to say, Anne, this is really helpful when I think about vocation, too, because there's a sense that God has this purpose for your life, and you just have to figure it out and go for it. And I've never had that sense, and my life's been much more random.
Right.
Take it as you go.
Yep.
This is very helpful to me. About that, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Bateson uses the language of vocation.
Yeah.
And the third session that I'll do this week is geared toward that. I'll just do a 60-second week's jumping ahead, and then if you have any questions for me afterwards, I'll be glad to stay with you. Tomorrow I'm going to be doing about a 1,000-year history relationship between religion and science and theology, starting with what I call the celestial spheres, or that sort of Middle Ages, what happens in music and religion and science, looking at the scientific revolution and Baroque music to classical and the Enlightenment, Romantic. We'll be doing listening tomorrow. If you like music, we'll be listening to some CDs, some things like that, to get sort of a grand sweep of this that takes us into this kind of period. It's interesting that when Bach's notion of improv, the figured bass, it's not as if improv's new. Bach, if you think about the music of the Baroque and improv, was related historically. It's not very far off from the introduction of the scientific revolution, which I think has some interesting plays, that this sort of tremendous cultural upheaval is also felt in the music. Yes?
Isn't it true that the earliest Bach manuscripts of the same piece are different?
Right.
Different kinds of embellishments.
Exactly.
Yeah, in Baroque music, I mean, they have a few notes, and they really never just played those notes. They're often always embellishing it, and they're embellishing it differently.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's wonderful to see that as part of our history. The third section will be on, particularly on the kind of structure of improv. And Gary, my husband, will be doing part of that. And I'll be sort of counterposing that with some specific confirmation on creativity and the work of a psychologist named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. If you've read his book called Flow. Fourth section will be on the blues, particularly as a critique of Christianity and looking at the blues as a metaphor for the doctrine of the atonement. The final section will be on liturgy and how we deal with all this worship stuff. My home congregation is literally torn in half by worship wars. We have what I call fondly, they have to quiet the service in one, and then we have the traditional at the other, and they don't talk, you know, they just, it's painful. And we have two virtual separate congregations. So we'll be addressing some of those issues, but hopefully you'll be able to play a little, sing a little, listen a little during the week, and Gary will be helping me with most of the sessions the rest of the week. So I look forward to your return, and you're welcome to take these sheets with you. So thanks, and if you have any conversations, feel free to talk to me. Yes, if you really want it, take a nap.